Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. That debt is fraud, and we need to kind of understand what was put into place. Well, you need to understand, let me back up. We are being destroyed methodically by a very pernicious and nefarious bodies of men, organizations that are uniting in trying to destroy liberty. Putting that into perspective, the only way we can stop this progress of evil is understand that they have no authority to do these things, all of the things that they've put into place. Folks, the fact that you're a number, the fact that they claim that you are chattel, the fact that they claim that you have no claim, they have no authority to be able to go down that path, to do that, to make you chattel, and to take away your claims. The Constitution gave them no authority to create the corporations, to create all of this webbing to destroy us. The point is that we are supposed to be supporting the Constitution. If you go out and support a myopic organization, then you're only supporting maybe a glimpse of the Constitution in one little facet, such as the Second Amendment, I'm going to keep my guns. But you're not supporting truly the restoration of the militia and your responsibility of being a militia member and all of those things that go along with that Second Amendment. On top of that, the rest of the Constitution is being destroyed as well. And essence, you are turning your back on the rest of the Constitution just so you can keep your guns. And they're not going to do you any good because we don't have muskets anymore. They are coming to bear with all sorts of weapons that what you have will be wholly inadequate. I'm telling you, the most effective and most powerful weapon we have today is greater than any bomb made by man or any weapon made by man today. And that weapon is the Constitution. It is the law. When we, the people, demand the enforcement of the law, we will get the enforcement of the law. But the reason we're not there doing that is because you believe in just enforcing the Second Amendment. And the rest of the law is being completely ignored and discarded. If we unite on demanding full compliance of the Constitution, the entire law will be restored and we will force government to get back within the framework of those powers enumerated and not doing the things they have no authority and power to do, such as creating that debt and spending the money on those things they have no authority to do that creates that debt, and on and on and on. We have to help, and we're here to go through this. This is a year curriculum where we start off with all the historical documents, and right now everything centers around the Constitution. Between this going through Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, then we're going to go through the ratification debates. And then we'll actually start diving into, you know, the very first acts of Congress and some of the things that they did. And we're going to really highlight how the government went down these paths of violating the Constitution by doing things they had no authority to do, how this all started. And we start connecting the dots for you that once they started doing this, then they claimed they could do that. And nobody was the wiser. Well, I guess they're doing that, so why can't they do that? And the judiciary was running interference, saying that of course we can do these things. We're the federal government. This is why you need to understand these things. You need to learn these things to help us understand what we have to restore, what it is that our end product is to be, this limited and defined government. With that, then we can get on our knees after learning and pray for us to understand these functions of what we have to do to force compliance. And then we have to get up and act. This is why everything hinges upon full compliance of the Constitution. Quit wasting your time and our time in worrying about the convention. Quit wasting your time and our time worrying about any of these myopic issues. We must unite. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm not a fan of theirs, and most organizations, most all conservative organizations, do not like me. I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to tell you what we have to do, and what we have to do has nothing to do with what they're telling you to do. Drop your membership with these organizations. You paying, you know, $50-$60 to be a part of the John Birch Society. Stop. It's a waste of money. It's a waste of your time and my time. All of these organizations need to start starving. They need to be forced to come to the trough of full compliance with the Constitution and helping the people demand this by starting in their counties and restoring your government in your county first. We are covering the notes on the Constitution Convention. We are going in through, and what Madison had started doing was he started reading how the Virginia plan has evolved to this point. We covered the first four resolutions. And so I believe we covered four. Is that not correct, Sean? Is that not correct, Tammy? Whoever mutes first wins,
sir.
What's
we
that?
We are on number four.
You know what? I'm going to double your wages. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to double your wages because you responded quickly. And Tammy, because you're there and, you know, you're equally as important, I'm going to triple your wages.
So,
just a little humor, folks, because nobody's paid here. Anywho, so we're on 5 and 6. Is that not correct? And I think, Sean, you were going to dive into those.
Number 4 is.
Okay, 4 and 5. That's right. All right, that's fine.
All right, number 4, resolved that the members of the second branch of the national legislature ought to be chosen by the individual legislatures to be of the age of 30 years at least, to hold their offices for a term sufficient to ensure their independency, namely 7 years, to receive fixed stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, to be paid out of the national treasury, to be ineligible to any office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States, except those peculiarly belonging to the functions of the second branch during the term of service and under the national government for the space of 1 year after its expiration.
Go ahead and read 5.
Resolve that each branch ought to possess the right of originating acts.
Now, each branch of the legislature. So the branch of the second legislature of the national legislature will be chosen by the individual legislators in Congress. No, that's not in Congress. That is the individual state. That's the state legislatures. Okay. And when we look, and they did. It looks like they actually implemented the compromise because 3, the people did it. So Tammy with 6, go ahead.
Resolved that the national legislature ought to be empowered to enjoy the legislative rights vested in Congress by the Confederation and moreover to legislate in all cases to which the separate states are incompetent or in which the harmony of the United States may be interpreted by the exercise of individual legislation to negative all laws passed by the several states contravening in the opinion of the national legislature the Articles of Union or any treaties subsisting under the authority of the Union.
Okay, so they're still sticking to this idea that they're going to be able to reduce the states more to an administrative condition and contain their ability to create law that would, you know, be contrary to what the national legislature is, you know, going to decide what it's going to rule. Again, they have not really delineated what objects they can legislate on. It seems at this point that they were to be general objects. Okay. So, Sean, 7.
Resolved that the right of suffrage in the first branch of the national legislature ought not to be according to the rule established in the Articles of Confederation, but according to some equitable ratio of representation, namely, in proportion to the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age, sex, and condition, including those bound to servitude for a term of years, and 3/5 of all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, except Indians not paying taxes in each state.
Now, was that is that wordsmithing for slaves?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was the first thing I thought about when I read that was, oh, that's a nice way of saying slaves.
Uh-huh. And, you know, why was I understand that there's sometimes you got to say something, you just don't want to taste the words. But you own it. We know what you're saying. So why don't you just say it? And I honestly,
yeah, whose feelings were they afraid of hurting?
Well, this was the southern states. The southern states wanted to make sure that they weren't, you know, highlighting themselves, because they were just kind of this 3/5 and ambiguous, so that nobody would really, I mean, if you don't dive into it, you don't know what that means and who that's affecting and where that's being practiced, because currently the states that were practicing it, most all the states were giving it up, getting rid of slavery. And there were only 3 that were actively trying to protect it. Okay. So, Tammy, let's take a look. And why don't you read Resolution 8 and 9? Thank you.
Resolved that the right of suffrage in the second branch of the national legislature ought to be according to the rule established for the first. 9, resolved that a national executive be instituted to consist of a single person to be chosen by the national legislature for the term of 7 years, with power to carry into execution the national laws, to appoint to offices in cases not otherwise provided for, to be ineligible a second time, and to be removable on impeachment and conviction of malpractice or neglect of duty, to receive a fixed stipend by which we may be compensated for the devotion of his time to public service, to be paid out of the national treasury.
Okay, so Sean, why don't you read Resolutions 10 and 11 if nobody has any questions or problems with, you know, the removal of somebody, that they're going to be compensated, but they will be punished for, you know, failure to act or their negligence, what have you. So, okay, so 11, or yeah, 10 is no 10 and 11. Go ahead.
11. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that I'm glad that they changed that, because you could see the dangers of the executive being chosen by the legislature. That's just got corruption written all over it.
Mm-hmm.
Number 10, resolved that the national executive shall have a right to negative any legislative act which shall not be afterwards passed unless by 2/3 of each branch of the national legislature. 11, resolved that a national judiciary be established to consist of 1 supreme tribunal, the judges of which to be appointed by the second branch of the national legislature, to hold their offices during good behavior, to receive punctually at stated times a fixed compensation for their services, in which no increase or diminution shall be made so as to affect the persons actually in office at the time of such increase or diminution.
Okay. That they are forming a judiciary, thus dividing the magistrate of the current national government into 3 separate and distinctive branches, and in so doing, they are dividing the roles and responsibilities of the magistrate. Folks, if you understand what I just said, that means that the president is not the magistrate. He is only the person that will execute the laws. The judiciary is not the magistrate, because technically the magistrate is where the powers or the sovereignty of creating and removing law and taxing the people come from. The highest powers of government are those powers, legislative and taxing. Therefore, the legislature or Congress is that ultimate power in the government. And yet they act like feckless, you know, well, there's probably a lot of colorful words. I will choose not to continue. I will stop myself there. And so now Tammy's going to read resolutions 12 and 13.
I think we're out of time.
It's 8 minutes. Sorry.
Okay. Resolve that the national legislature be empowered to appoint inferior tribunals. Resolve the jurisdiction of the national judiciary shall extend to cases which respect the collection of the national revenue, impeachments of any national officers, and questions which involve the national peace and harmony.
Kind of generic at this point. But the fourth one, and this is a particularly important one, we now see that they've added this resolution regarding the admission of states. Resolved that provisions ought to be made for the admission of states lawfully arising within the limits of the United States, whether from a voluntary junction of government and territory or otherwise, with the consent of a number of voices in the national legislature less than the whole. In other words, it doesn't need to be unanimous, but it's really still ambiguous of what they're trying to say there. And they weren't identifying the details of representation and all those types of things that they still needed to work out, but at least it's been added. So, Sean, go ahead and let's do 15 and 16.
Resolved that provision ought to be made for the continuance of Congress and their authorities until a given day after reform of the Articles of Union shall be adopted, and for the completion of all their engagements. 16. Resolved that a Republican Constitution and its existing laws ought to be guaranteed to each state by the United States.
Okay, that a Republican Constitution and its existing laws ought to be guaranteed to each state. Okay, interesting. So that's where the guarantee clause comes in. I guess they wanted to make sure that all the states in the Union, but they weren't really saying it that way, but they wanted to make sure all states in the Union were Republican in form. Okay, so Tammy, 17 and 18.
We can resolve that provision ought to be made for the amendment of the Articles of Union whensoever it shall seem necessary. Resolve that the legislative, executive, and judiciary powers within the several states ought to be bound by oath to support the Articles of Union.
Okay, so in Articles of the Union. So kind of bled out on me there. But anyway, so right here, they're inducing a mark or a marker for amendments to the Constitution without really getting into the details in the process. And that the fact that, you know, they're looking at the powers of the several states being bound by an oath. Everybody, all public servants that are in some form of public office representing the people or in governing the people and or in judging the people in any way are to basically be held to an oath and, you know, to support the Constitution. That's what ultimately it's going to be. We know that. Okay, so now, Sean, let's do
number 19.
19, yeah, and then go ahead and read the final comment. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Resolved that the amendments which shall be offered to the Confederation by the Convention ought at a proper time or times after the approbation of Congress to be submitted to an assembly or assemblies of representatives recommended by several legislatures to be expressly chosen by the people to consider and decide thereon. Of Mr. Randolph's plan as reported from the committee, the one proposition that a national government ought to be established considering and et cetera being taken up in the House.
All right, so actually that last resolved was kind of interesting. I don't know what you thought, but it's basically kind of stating that who's going to ratify the amendment based on that line?
The people.
Well, actually read it.
Representatives of the people.
Okay, so representatives recommended by the several legislatures. In other words, the state legislatures, not the people.
By the people.
The cabals, those people in power. I agree with you that they should be elected by the people, but at this point, they're still pointing to the state legislatures as the grand poobah of the states, of how all that's to be done. Other than the fact that in the House of Representatives, in the first legislature, that had shifted for the first time to including that the people would choose their representatives. And so I think it becomes logical that that paradigm starts to grow legs as they move forward with this Constitution, that they want to include the people more and more, that the amendments, ratification, that type of stuff. Or at least with the Constitution itself, when it came to the Constitution, and it's even a proviso in Article 5 that an amendment for ratification can go to the state legislatures or to a convention of delegates elected by the people. So, anywho, now they start chewing on all of this. Now that they've had Hamilton's plan, Madison's comments, and then Madison kind of read, okay, this is what we've got so far. Mr. Wilson then pipes in and makes his feelings known. So go ahead, Tammy.
Mr. Wilson observed that by a national government, he did not mean one that would swallow up the state governments, as seemed to be wished by some gentlemen, was tenacious of the idea of preserving the latter, thought contrary to the opinion of Colonel Hamilton that they might not only subsist, but subsist on friendly terms with the former. They were absolutely necessary for certain purposes which the former could not reach. At large, governments must be subdivided into lesser jurisdictions. As examples, he mentioned Persia, Rome, and particularly the divisions and subdivisions of England by Alfred.
Okay. Now, Hamilton hearing his name and still being on the premises, he kind of rises up and says, go ahead, John.
Colonel Hamilton coincided with the proposition as it stood in the report. He had not been understood yesterday.
Okay.
By an abolition of the states, he meant that no boundary could be drawn between the national and the state legislatures, that the former must therefore have indefinite authority. If it were limited at all, the rivalship of the states would gradually subvert it. Even as corporations, the extent of some of them as Virginia, Massachusetts, etc., would be formidable, as states he thought they ought to be abolished, but he admitted the necessity of leaving in them subordinate jurisdictions. The examples of Persia and the Roman Empire cited by Mr. Wilson were, he thought, in favor of his doctrine. The great powers delegated to the satraps and proconsuls having frequently produced revolts and schemes of independence.
Okay, so we can hear the music, and so we know what that means. No, that's not the music to the end of the show. That's the music that leads us into a promo. Yay, so we got some more time for show here and more content. All right, so with that, we will pick up on some comments of how Hamilton did his, tap dance and hat. We'll be right back with this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Now, you gotta love lawyers and how they respond. Clearly, Mr. Wilson, he started his comment off, I think, being very clear by saying that he observed that by a national government, he did not mean that one would swallow up the state governments, as seemed to be wished by some gentlemen. And he was kind of pointing his finger at Hamilton. Hamilton coincided with the proposition as it stood. In other words, Hamilton kind of agreed with what was being proposed. In other words, he wasn't telling Mr. Wilson, no, I'm not that way. He was kind of admitting that he agreed with the proposition, but didn't really say right, wrong, or indifferent. Back to Mr. Wilson. You know, you accuse me of that, and yes, you're right. In other words, he kind of sidestepped that. Then Hamilton basically goes in and says, this is the side-oblique way to do this. By an abolition of the states, he meant that no boundary could be drawn between the national and state legislatures. In other words, what is a boundary between the national and state legislatures? It's a separator. In other words, where one actually has protection from the other, both equally being protected from each other. When you have a boundary, that's what happens. He's saying that no boundary can exist. They can't draw one. For this to succeed, the national government must swallow up the state governments. But then in a sideways way of going about it, it makes it seem like the states are still relevant when actually, based on the plan and the direction that the sentiments were heading by these prevailing, I'll just say, Hamilton, especially Hamilton, and I think some of the other big government advocates, that's the way they were going, that they were going to swallow them up. Okay, so now this is where we get into Mr. King's comments, and we will let Tammy cover Mr. King. Now, King is from where? Massachusetts. So Wilson, Pennsylvania, Hamilton, New York, two big states. Now Massachusetts, another big state, but they got a different paradigm because they are a small state. So go ahead.
Mr. King wished, as everything depended on this proposition, that no objections might be improperly indulged against the phraseology of it. He conceived that the import of the terms state, sovereignty, national, federal, had been often used and applied in the discussions inaccurately and delusively. The states were not sovereigns, in the sense contended for by some. They did not possess the peculiar features of sovereignty. They could not make war, nor peace, nor alliances, nor treaties. Considering them as political beings, they were dumb, for they could not speak to any foreign sovereign whatever.
Okay, Tammy, So let me ask you this. When you read this very beginning part, because this is my sentiments of most people, when they basically say that he conceived that the import of the terms And then he goes through these ambiguous things, as I've kind of been saying, that they've been really dancing around with these words, generalizing them. States, sovereignty, national, federal, had been often used and applied in discussions inaccurately and delusively. The states were not sovereigns in the sense contended for by some. Now, when you hear states are not sovereigns, then who are the sovereigns? And most people will tell you, because of this, I'll call it, this indoctrination of we the people, this indoctrination of democracy, that the people are the sovereigns. Now, Madison kind of alludes to the fact that the people are the fountain of political power, that when the people unite, they can change the direction, the control, they can do all sorts of things regarding the political power that they are, you know, giving up. But most people would think that the people are the sovereigns. And this is why, in Why Counties Matter Most, I clearly delineate how, you know, what government is sovereignty over. Because if you create a government, clearly you've given it sovereignty over very specific things. What that means is that if you have a county government and they have the authority, you've given them the ability to decide whether they put a stop sign on these two streets, or they put a stop sign on the direction of this street and a yield sign on the directions of this street, they're making that decision. You can't come along and change that and put the signs where you want them. You've delegated that authority to them to make that decision. And as then he points out, and it kind of got out of the hat faster than I could stop Tammy from reading, because she's so efficacious in getting the job done. They actually kind of pointed out that the states couldn't declare war. The states were unable to actually make treaties of trade. They didn't have that sovereignty. Even though the people may have given that to them in the Constitution, that was surrendered in the Articles of Confederation. So the government that was being created by the states to serve them, they had to relinquish that sovereignty that the people gave them and gave that to the general government of the Confederation, or I should say Continental Congress specifically. So when we really look at sovereignty, folks, we actually have what, and it's kind of disingenuous throughout all the times of history. It was, I guess maybe it was just hard to fathom, but it was really disingenuous to think at all times that even in a democracy, the people were the sovereigns. There had to be points in time where somebody was making the decision. Now, in a democracy, it's easy to pull that back, and it's easy to create chaos, and it's easy to create anarchy in a democracy, which is why they went down this Republican form. So as we look today, I think that we can easily, it's easier for us to comprehend that, you know, we all don't hold all of the abilities and all the responsibility of making decisions. That at work, there are people that make certain decisions. You may make certain decisions. If you're the CEO, you may be making all of them, but you really don't, because even the CEO delegates down to his directorates and so forth. For them, he gives them guidance and that they make the decisions. And sometimes he has to make corrections or has to deal with the consequences. But we live in a society where sovereignty isn't held by everybody. Sovereignty is pretty well distributed. And what we there's a way of referring to this in kind of a modern day language. We live in a day where we all have a mutual dependency on each other. That I expect you to do your job, and you should be expecting me to do my job. And we expect, you know, that guy that's, you know, picking up the trash to do his job and these other people to do their job because we've given that to them. And in many cases, we're paying them to do that job. So when we look at how we frame government, this goes back to, again, what I'm trying to emphasize. In framing government, when you delegate power, you are creating a sovereign to exercise power for you. And when they create a government, like the state, your county creates the state, they're basically delegating power to become sovereign over those few powers delegated. In America, that's done via constitutions. And throughout the world, it's done via constitutions. The question is, are you delegating general powers or are you delegating specified powers? And in America, they're specified. Everywhere else in the world, they're general. And when I look at the difference between a general and specified, I think of a general is like playing with kids. Because if you've ever watched kids start to play a game, and they kind of start off with some basic rules, they tend to make it up as they go along. Because it's their game, they started it, and they get to do that. And that's what happens when you kind of give discretionary powers to government. They become like, they act like kids and they make it up as they go along and they do it to serve themselves. Because anybody that has watched children play in that type of, you know, environment where they're making it up as they go along, you can tell the little kid that's making up the rules, they're creating favors for themselves. They're making advantages for themselves. I mean, I don't. Either of you ever noticed that? Have you ever seen kids and how quickly they start, you know, giving themselves the advantages? Yes, no, indifferent.
I have a question about sovereignty.
Yeah, go ahead. But I'm kind of curious. Have you ever watched kids when they're trying to create the rules of their game?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. They. Okay. Thank you, Tammy. You too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
in fact, I used to do activities like that when I was teaching to help the kids understand the dynamics of it.
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
But my question about sovereignty is, if the people are delegating specific powers to the government, then aren't they still the sovereigns?
Yeah, they're sovereigns.
Because they have the ultimate decision to give that power to someone else.
Yeah, but so once you've given the person the keys to the car, that car is theirs. And so you can't take those keys back unless you have enough of the people. Once the people agree to give those keys back, and then a few people have buyer's remorse. You know, there's always going to be those few people. No, don't do it. Right? There's those guys. And they're the ones that will say, I told you so. They're going to try to get other people. And it takes a majority of the people to say, we need those keys back. And that's what amendments are for. That's what amendments are there to change, you know, the powers given to take or give away those powers. In other words, we're going to give you more or we're going to take away those powers. That's the whole point of amending. In the Constitution, once you put it in writing, you have the authority to do this. That's been delegated. It is theirs. Now, there are
that specific power or responsibility.
Yes, and the people still have sovereignty.
For example,
go ahead.
Religious practices.
Right.
We did not delegate that to anyone. We still retain that as the people.
Thank you.
So
yes.
I have the right. So I am sovereign over my decisions about my religious preferences, practices, what have you.
Right. But see, the danger throughout history was everybody was living in a community that they thought they all could agree. They are all of the same faith. You know, they were all kind of, you know, the same people, kind of the same families, and they've been living together and they've kind of matured as a society and said, we're going to create a government. We're going to give government power. So they didn't know to hold back power. They just gave them general power. The only nation that ever created an enumerated or a specified and limited constitution is the United States, the only one, which means that there are still societies today that have not woken up to say, that's not a good thing, giving these people governing us, this family, this carte blanche control over us. Now, in England, the only nation that kind of created the first layer of protection for the people was by using a Bill of Rights. They gave the king general powers, and they said, yeah, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't take this from us, this from us, this from us, this from us, this from us. And when they moved forward into creating the Constitution, they felt it was easier to create, or actually to identify, the powers delegated than it would be to identify all of the rights that they needed to protect from government by giving them all the powers. See, and when we go through the ratification debates, this becomes very clear. But go ahead, Tammy. Tammy?
You want me to keep reading?
No. You were saying something.
No, I was just agreeing with you that it would be harder to point out everything.
That's correct.
Instead of just...
Yeah, and you get that out of the ratification base, because that was the constant argument back when they said, we need a Bill of Rights. We've got to have a Bill of Rights. And say, well, only a fool would think of Bill of Rights was real protection. It's far better to limit them to only these powers than to say, hey, give them all the powers, and then, well, shoot, what do we need to protect ourselves from? Because you're going to find out quick, oh, you didn't mention this, and they're going to take it from you. Anyway.
Yeah, that was where my question derived about the sovereignty, because the government doesn't have the right to do whatever it thinks it wants to do. We still have that sovereignty, and we delegate specific things to them.
Yeah, so there's one unique thing about our foundation of creating government. First off, governments are instituted by we the people. In other words, these fundamental declarations in the Declaration of Independence that created this axiom that we the people were going to institute government. And in so doing, we were going to specify how they were to govern us instead of giving them control over us, as we had for the past several centuries under the rule of Britain allowed the king to do. We were changing that. And the other fundamental plank, or the other fundamental tenet of our system, is that we the people have the right to alter, abolish, and or change, and or institute new governments. We have this right as people. In other words, when you believe that your state government is so far out of hand that, you know, they basically have proven their inability to truly serve the people, that they're ruling the people instead, then the people have a right to abolish that government and start a new one. And don't let any judge or any politician or bureaucrat tell you otherwise. That is a fundamental tenet that was the foundation of this nation. The only problem is...
That's the premise of my perspective, is that the people are sovereign and we decide how the government is going to be instituted and what powers it will have.
Right.
Whereas in England, the monarch was the sovereign, and he granted things to the people.
Yeah, but see, he was the sovereign appointed by God.
And now we're the sovereign.
Yeah. I know, but there's a huge difference there. But in addition, to help you, and agree, I'm agreeing with you, and to help, I think, get this clear here, is that when Madison laid it out, instead of calling them the sovereigns, they are the fountain of political power, because the real problem comes down to, as we see here, not all people are going to agree. And we reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree, but getting them one equally informed and all understanding on all of the issues to agree upon everything becomes very, very hard to do. But if we limit government, and then we say it's easier to agree on a few things than everything. Well, we're going to have them declare war. Okay, we don't like it, but we got to have that because we can't wait for having a national vote to go whether we go to war while we're being attacked. So as we look at this idea of the people having sovereignty, I think Madison provided the paradigm that the people are the they're the fountain of political power. That if you get enough of the people to agree, you can shift government correctly, or to correct government, you shift it. You can move it this way, you can move it that way. But as a society, the greatest danger comes to a people that had government and no longer has government. In other words, they knew, because the whole point of democracy, and they talked about this often, that when you have a democracy, it ebbs and flows. It's like a teeter, a seesaw, and it teeters back and forth from tyranny to anarchy. In other words, everybody's happy, they got a great king, and everything's going well, and then the king gets corrupt, and he becomes more oppressive, more oppressive, more oppressive, till the people get so upset that they off the head of the king, and now they don't have a king, and now we need to rebuild. And in that whole process, it teeters back into pure anarchy. So it goes from oppression or despotism to anarchy, back and forth. That is a democracy. And there's always these dangers and these lulls when all of a sudden you've gotten rid of your monarch, you've gotten rid of, you know, whatever that government is that you've created. In a republican form of government, you don't have a king. The law is your king. So by having the law, you don't have to worry about, you know, having to off the head. You just have to worry about enforcing the law, because usually the problem with kings or people is that you start interpreting or granting more power to themselves, assuming more power, you know, basically, you know, practicing, you know, this evil in their dominion over us. But when it's the law, all we need to do is make sure the law is tuned and corrected. If there's a problem with the law, you amend the law. And that way you have a much more stable government and less chance of having to lose it, so that you don't have to suffer through the anarchy, because that's exactly what happens. And that's exactly what they're trying to do in all of these different states. They're trying to destroy the state government to create anarchy, to enforce, or basically to help, you know, institute this push towards statism, instead of, you know, going back to the framework we're supposed to have, which is why civilly minded people that are thinking and working in common sense, logic, and reason, not looking to take deadly force or any type of measure, but taking a stand and saying, we want you to comply to the law. The law is clear. You're not complying to it. So you've got to go. And by enforcing the law, it keeps us from basically cutting our law's head off and causing anarchy, if that helps. Does that help?
Oh, yes, sir. I understand exactly what you're saying. Okay, we can see examples of it right now in what they're trying to do. Like you said, in these different areas where they're releasing the criminals back in, they're using fraud to decimate the economy. And that's what they're trying to do. And it, like you said, I can see where democracy will lead straight to tyranny, because once you get the majority of a certain area or a certain group of people, then they're going to vote, just like we saw in the scriptures, they're going to vote for things that are against their own best interest, because they've been promised something in return.
Okay.
And then you can't vote your way out of socialism. Because once the tyrants are in place, then they have the force on their side.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so Tammy, go ahead and pick it back up. I'm sorry for the interruption. I thought it was important, though. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. They were deaf.
Mm-hmm.
For they could not hear any propositions from such sovereign. They had not even the organs or faculties of defense or offense, for they could not of themselves raise troops or equip vessels for war. On the other side, the union of the states comprises the idea of a confederation. It comprises that also of consolidation. A union of the states is a union of the men composing them, for whence a national character results to the whole. Congress can can act alone without the states. Their acts will be binding against the instructions of the states. If they declare war, war is de jure declared, captures made in pursuance of it are lawful. No acts of the states can vary the situation or prevent the judicial consequences. If the states, therefore, retain some portion of their sovereignty, they had certainly divested themselves of essential portions of it. If they formed a confederacy, in some respects they formed a nation in others. The convention could clearly deliberate on and propose any alterations that Congress could have done under the federal articles, and could not Congress propose by virtue of the last article a change in any article whatever, and as well that relating to the equality of suffrage as any other. He made these remarks to obviate some scruples which had been expressed. He doubted much the practicability of annihilating the states, but thought that much of their power ought to be taken from them. Mr. Martin said he considered that the separation from Great Britain placed the 13 states in a state of nature towards each other, that they would have remained in that state till this time, but for the confederation that they entered into the confederation on the footing of equality that they met now to amend it on the same footing, and that he could never accede to a plan that would introduce an inequality and lay 10 states at the mercy of Virginia, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania.
Okay. All right. So we made it through. We got about a minute left. There's no point in probably moving forward. Okay. So he kind of goes through what I would just say as, you know, this this point of dealing with, and, you know, I guess somebody had to state the obvious, that there was way too much ambiguity, that's the word I'll use, in how they were addressing these things. Because, and as a matter of fact, to give the allowance for the ambiguity, there was clearly no agreed or delineation of exactly how these things were going to work. They were just kind of creating the direction that way. And that's pretty ambiguous. We're going this way. And this way doesn't, you know, it's not on the compass. I mean, this could be east, west, north, south, doesn't matter. This is the way we're going. And it's completely independent of that direction, other than the fact that this is where we're going. That ambiguous. They're just trying to figure out the framework and then start filling in those blanks. And that is right there where, you know, that's where all the work comes in filling in those blanks of what does this executive do? What does Congress do? What are the powers given to Congress? What general powers are they going to have or specified? Same thing with the judiciary. Roles, responsibilities, powers, standards, property, all of those types of things, they had to start enumerating, or they had to provide general powers. And so I think that there was probably a deal of frustration, because they were struggling on, you know, okay, we're going this way before we could actually start working together. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.